Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to class today. It's good to see everyone. I know we had some people that were absent last week with power failures and ice and sickness and who knows what else. So it's good to see some of you back this morning. If you have in front of you a set of notes, Grace History Project Lesson 120, the Stan GBC controversy, and there already is a mistake on there that needs to be fixed. This is part four, not part three. That's my mistake. Mislabeled, so it should say part four. Now, if you were not here last week and you would like the notes that you missed, see me afterwards and we can make sure that you get those. Okay. So this is Lesson 120, and again, the title is the Stan GBC controversy part four. And so what we've been doing over the last, the previous three studies is been looking at trying to understand the dynamic of what happened between Stan and Grace Bible College that led to a split, that led to Stan leaving the GGF and a group of men moving to form the BBF, or the Berean Bible Fellowship. So we're sort of in the middle of that, and what we've been doing is surveying the letter writing that occurred between 1966, throughout the end of 1966, 1967, and 1968, to try to understand from the primary documents themselves what the major issues were and why Stan decided that it was better for him to leave the GGF. I've got up here a sort of list of some key events that we've been dealing with, okay? I went all the way back this time to the death of O'Hare in 1958. I don't think that's inconsequential in all of this. I think that O'Hare was a highly charismatic individual in the sense of, and his personality sort of held things together. And I don't think it's a coincidence that after O'Hare dies, within 10 years, you start to see this type of infighting amongst some of these brethren manifesting itself. Then we had the 1964 journal article by Erickson advocating the reading of the writings of D.H. Lawrence as part of the curriculum of students of the college. Stan objected to that. In the spring of 1966, we surveyed the journal article written by David Weddle, The Spirit of Bereanism, and how that played a major role. We looked at, in the summer of 1966, the Farrell letter addressed to Banker. DeWitt characterized that as the sort of the first sign of trouble, or the first shot across the bow, as the word of controversy. Then the fall of 66 commences this series of letter writing and meetings that were being held to address the issues, the various issues of the controversy. And this last point here we haven't got to yet, we're going to cover today, the September 1967 GGF Pastors Conference at the Ascot Motel in Chicago, Illinois. Okay, we're going to be looking at that. So that's sort of a summary, okay? If you look at the different sides, on the Stan side, Stan's major issues are neo-evangelicalism. I'm just going to say N-E, all right? We spent a lot of time studying what that meant. Underneath that, his intellectualism, he views as a problem at the college. And these are his two issues. And on the side of the college, and we've seen this in the last few studies, that from their standpoint, they adopt a position that they're not neo-evangelical in the sense of their dispensationalism. Okay, so in other words, part of the neo-evangelical movement was this anti-dispensationalism that we studied. What the college said is, we're not neo-evangelical in the sense that we're against dispensationalism. They retain their dispensationalism. What we've seen in the last two studies, how they adopted this position, particularly the faculty of the college, that anything was fair game. Anything was fair game to be taught, so long as it did not violate the doctrinal statement of the college and of the GGF. Okay? So we've been looking at sort of this range of values on the Stan side, on the college side. The college is perceiving Stan to be somewhat unfair and not conducting itself in a manner that's above board. And so you have these two different opinions that could be just generally summed up with those two statements. And so if you look at the notes, 1967 continued. Vernon, and there's a typo there, it should say Vernon A. Schutz, to the administration of Grace Bible College. This was written sometime in the summer of 1967. The exact date on the document that I had in front of me when I went over this was somewhat deteriorated, so I could not tell exactly when in the summer it was written, but it clearly fits the summer of 1967. So if you look at the statement, the first point here, unfortunately the first page of this letter had suffered some deterioration and was very hard to read. However, pages 2 through 4 survived intact and made for very interesting reading. In this letter, Schutz expresses his thoughts regarding the ongoing controversy between STAM and Grace Bible College. Schutz, whom I have always had much respect for, if you don't know Schutz, he wrote a couple very helpful little booklets. One on the assigned gifts, one on three Bible churches, and another one on water baptism. Not real long books, but real short, but real good, real useful material that he put together there. Schutz, who I had always had much respect for, sided with Baker and Dean against Stamp. Schutz viewed the dilemma as stemming from a, quote, contentious spirit, that he had seen developing for a good while. Schutz perceived that arguing with Stamm about the facts was a waste of time because, quote, we are not dealing so much with a set of factual issues, but an attitude. All caps there is Schutz's way of stating it, okay? So what Schutz is saying is that in dealing with Stamm really doesn't care about the facts of what's going on. There's an attitude issue or problem on Stamm's part. Now that's Schutz's understanding or perception of the situation in this letter dated the summer of 67. Schutz took exception to an article published by Stamm in the April 1967 issue of the Searchlight. In an article titled On Two Sides of the Fence, Stamm made it appear to his readers that Jack Dean vacillates in declaring himself a fundamentalist. Quote from the Schutz letter now. Mr. Stamm does not state Dr. Dean's true position. Dr. Dean is merely being cautious, as I am, in reference to the term fundamentalist. So often today, the term fundamentalist no longer carries a theological connotation. This term is often used in the sense of a narrow-minded, bigoted, backbiting, belligerent person who fights against everything and anything and with anybody. In some circles, this is what is meant by fundamentalist. And I hasten to add, I hope these circles do not consider me a fundamentalist in their sense of the term. I always answer the question, are you a fundamentalist, by saying, if by fundamentalist you mean fundamentalist in its theological sense, yes, I'm a fundamentalist. But if you mean by the terms a person who is contentious in the faith, then I trust I am not that. This is what Jack Dean meant by his statement, I am not a fundamentalist in certain circles as defined in certain ways. What is wrong with this? This is what Brother Dean does. I know, I talked with him. But Monsieur Sparrow and Stamm have also talked with him, and still they interpret Jack Dean erroneously and have made it appear that Dean is playing on two sides of the fence. It seems to me that these brethren are indeed fundamentalists in the contentious sense of the word. So Schutz is a little bit upset here, okay? And he's saying that what he's doing is saying, look, when Jack Dean said, I'm not a fundamentalist, in certain sense defined in certain ways, what he's saying is similar to what Schutz is arguing here. We'll see that in a minute. But what he's actually saying is the one who's the contentious one is who? Stamm. Next, Schutz attacks Stamm's statements that Dean is a neo-evangelical. Quoting again, Mr. Stamm is quick to point out where Dean's convictions seem to parallel with the neo-evangelical approach to evangelism. When Jack says that we should not buttonhole a person or be offensive to friends, relatives, and neighbors, incidentally, as I understood Mr. Stamm when he taught us personal evangelism, he said, in substance, the same thing. Both these brethren had these convictions before the term neo-evangelicalism was coined. I know I did. just a comment about that. You need to understand, Schutz was a student at Milwaukee Bible College when Stan was one of the professors. So when Schutz is saying this, he's saying, look, he's accusing Dean of things that Stan himself taught when he was teaching at the school about how to handle yourself in evangelism before the term neo-evangelical was even in use. So again, this is Schutz's estimation of what's going on. Now, continuing with the quote, now because Jack Dean's own personal conviction may agree with the neo-evangelical position here, does this make him a neo-evangelical? Dean may agree with them in some areas, as do I in some areas. If this makes us neo-evangelicals, is it not incorrect to call us ultra-dispensationalists because we agree with them in some areas also? Just because a man's point of view may at times parallel with another group, this does not make him one of that particular group. Roman Catholics believe in the Trinity, virgin birth, and inspiration of the Scriptures, and so do I. Would you label me a Roman Catholic? Of course not. If you did, you would be guilty of conjuring a caricature, which according to definition is a ludicrous exaggeration or distortion. Neither should we brand each other neo-Orthodox or neo-evangelical simply because our points of view at times run parallel with theirs in certain areas. Schutz is a little fired up here. Okay? And he's taking Stan to task over how he's conducting himself. Accusing them of being neo-evangelicals because there are a few points of belief that overlap with the neo-evangelical agenda. And what Schutz is saying, look, if that's going to be the standard, then are we ultra-dispensationalists? Are we Roman Catholics? Because there are points of agreement that we have on different issues of doctrine with ultra-dispensationalists and with Roman Catholics. Schutz's ultimate estimation is no. What this is doing is creating a caricature, and it's a caricature that's not a complete representation of everything that, you know, Dean himself held to in terms of these things. So I'm going to finish the next point, and then we'll take any questions. Schutz viewed the tactics of Stamm and Farrell as being the very same as used against the Grace Movement by their opponents who sought to brand them as ultra-dispensationalists. Quoting again, the whole approach made by these men falls under reproach here. It appears to me that their labels of, quote, liberal and neo-evangelical are caricatures designed to prejudice and inflame their listeners against some of our Grace Brethren and the school. To create a caricature and then proceed to demolish this in God's name, as though we are some kind of champion, is one of the wiles of the devil. Our opponents have done this to us with the caricature of ultra-dispensationalists, and now some of our own brethren seem to be using such tactics on their own Grace Brethren. End of the quote. We need to have a quotation mark, Sylvia, at the end of that one. Alright, seems like a good place to stop. Any questions or comments at this point about Mr. Schutz's letter? It's pretty straightforward letter. I mean, frankly, some of what he's saying is sort of hard to argue with in terms of, you know, some of the things that we've observed, particularly last week, if you were here for that lesson. You remember that William Root in California was basically bringing up some of these exact same, in his letter, in William Root's letter, he was bringing up some of these same issues that Schutz is mentioning here. Schutz's letter is much more articulate in the sense of how he's describing what he perceives to be going on. So from this side, they perceive him to be very sort of underhanded, if you will, in the way he's dealing with them. He perceives them on this side to not be being straightforward and dodging and refusing to answer direct questions. So there's a real sort of fundamental disagreement here that is probably going beyond simply the neo-evangelical, non-neo-evangelical. Just to throw out the question, Any reaction to Schutz when he uses this example of the caricature of ultra-dispensationalism being used by the opponents of the grace movement and his perception that Stam is sort of doing the same thing with trying to pigeonhole Dean and others here? Lee?
I think there was a carefulness on Pastor Schutz's part. I remember, not on this specific issue, but when we would get in a discussion about the 12 in or the 12 out, some of you may not understand that. I think it's a very serious issue. But he didn't want that spoken about. He didn't want that brought to the floor. I made the mistake of preaching on it at a national convention, and well, they button hold me in a hurry because it's controversial. And I think, quite frankly, in that whole thing, there was, the issue was not right or wrong, left or right, the issue was controversy. We want to avoid controversy at all costs. And I think that did the, my personal opinion, especially on the college side, I think that's jaded or colored their comments and view.
Quoted from last week's notes, from a May 1967 special addendum to Truth magazine, there's a published open letter to a pastor. It says, the pastor of one of our grace churches has written to the college stating that he has received warning that Grace Bible College is becoming neo-evangelical, and since one of the chief tenets of neo-evangelicalism is anti-dispensationalism, he must know if there is any truth to this charge. There may be others who have become upset by similar allegations, and therefore we have felt it wisely to print this reply as an open letter. And then another quote from last week's notes, they actually say in another article in Truth magazine that he is the one that is completely responsible for bringing the controversy to the wider constituency of the GGF, not the college. If the college was trying to, as Lee just said, not or avoid controversy on these issues. So I don't know how that fits into your statement, particularly about Schutz, but it seems to be jiving with that. Would you agree, Lee?
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments at this point? Okay. Schutz also, halfway down the page, Schutz also points out that Stam ought to have been more understanding of problems that arise within the student body, given that Stam used to be dean. Quote, I cannot help but comment on the accusation that Mr. Dean and Mr. Baker are defensive about the spiritual problems of the school. The school has always had such problems. I remember some very serious ones arose when Mr. Stam was acting dean at Milwaukee. If we, students, had chosen to let some of this out, it would have indeed caused a scandal. Mr. Stam seems to forget how helpless he was to prevent such occurrences, nor does he seem to be the least bit sympathetic or understanding toward the present administration. So here what Schutz is basically saying is, look, Stam can be critical all he wants to of the college and their board, but he used to be the dean. He used to be the one that was in charge of student discipline, and he knows full well that he couldn't control everything that these students were doing when he was the acting dean. And for him to now be just excoriating Baker and Jack Dean for similar things going on under their watch, Schutz views this as just highly unfair. Schutz does agree with Stam that the writings of D.H. Lawrence are immoral. Schutz compares Stam and Farrell to the Pope and the Archbishop of the Church of England in terms of their tactics. Quote, in reading over this material, I get the distinct impression that Messrs. Farrell and Stam, these self-appointed executioners and guardians of the faith, depending on your point of view, I suppose, are very much like the Pope of Rome and the Archbishop of the Church of England. Steele said of these two churches that the only difference between them is that the Church of Rome is infallible and the Church of England is never wrong. So The Schutz letter is interesting to me in the sense that it brings out more of an understanding of what the personal dynamic is here and what his estimation of the tactics of Sam, that Sam and Farrell were using was. Mike?
Isn't Schutz using the analogy of, the fallacy of false analogy here when he compares, just because Roman Catholics believe in the Trinity and have that in common with us, that we, the same thing is going on here at Grace Bible College, and between, they seem to be talking past each other. The issue that Sam is complaining about is cooperative evangelism at the school. He's not even dealing with issues that are going on.
I think yes and no. I think where he goes wrong is when he brings up the thing about Rome. When he's just talking about somebody in their personal views about evangelism might correspond with certain aspects of the neo-evangelical agenda, that does not make them a complete neo-evangelical. I think he's probably right there. But when he goes that step further that you just mentioned, I think he probably is on much shakier ground from the way I perceive what's going on. And I'm sort of privy to some information that's going to come up later here that hopefully will help you understand that I got directly from DeWitt in a conversation I had with him. Any other questions or comments? All right, September 19, 1967, Sam to an unnamed pastor. Sam speaks of an August GGF council meeting that took place during the Winona Lake Convention. Sam writes that during this meeting, Wynne Johnson, Herbert Hines, and C.R. Sam pressed for an afternoon panel discussion about the Grace Bible College problem, with perhaps Messrs. Baker and Dean on one side and Wynne Johnson and Sam on the other. According to Sam, he suggested that, quote, the meetings be open to the GGF constituency since so many parents and lay people were already involved. According to Sam, this suggestion was overruled in favor of a, quote, special pastor's conference to be held September 26th through 28th to discuss the issue. When I asked whether we might bring certain laymen along, the majority ruled that the conference should be for pastors only. Sam complains that he learned on September 3rd that the GGF Council was planning to have its laymen attend, to which Sam replied in a letter to the National Secretary, Dan Baltima, stating, quote, it was the official decision of the Council that the meeting be open to pastors only. I'm interested to know what the format of these meetings will be. I had suggested one. Does our side have no voice in deciding this? We have not as yet been contacted about it. Also, some council members mentioned taping the proceedings. Will this be done? If so, we should be notified so we can do the same. End of that quote. Receipt of Baltimore's reply brought the following amazing revelation, according to Sam. Quote, after Wynne Johnson and I were off the council and its membership was stacked in favor of the college, so apparently something happens here. I need to interject this. Sometime between the August council meeting and the writing of this letter, Sam and Wynne Johnson are no longer on the GGF council. I don't know if that's by their own choice or if they were somehow forced off of the council. He doesn't say. But it's obvious when you read this that he is no longer on the GGF Council at the time of the writing of this letter. After Wynne Johnson and I were off the Council and his membership was stacked in favor of the college, the Council decided that it would be conducting proceedings at the pastor's conference in which one tape recorder would be permitted. Theirs. Note the proceedings are not to be taped to provide you with, and us with copies. Brother Baltimore's letter states, quote, the council has voted for one tape recorder to be allowed, and all sessions will be taped, which will be for the official record of the GGF. So there you have it. We are to have impartial proceedings by a council already overwhelmingly committed to the defense of GBC. The president himself, also president of Grace Bible College. They can have their laymen attend, but we can't. They can tape our statements, but we can't tape theirs. and only upon injury, and only upon inquiry, sorry, we learn of this on September 16th, just 10 days before the conference is to begin. We are not consulted about the conference in any way. This arbitrary action certainly makes it appear again that the defenders of Grace Bible College do not want this matter discussed on equal terms over open Bibles. They want to silence us. After reading Brother Dan's letter, I immediately called Wynn Johnson and Jeff Farrell to ask them to think and pray as to what we should do now. The result... We have unanimously decided that we will not take part in any such proceedings. We are not on trial. If anybody is on trial, it is Grace Bible College for published statements and pursuit policies which violate the plainest scripture and dishonor God we are supposed to serve. But most assuredly, we will not participate in any hearing held on the above arbitrary and unequal terms. We are not about to be stoned into silence. We will attend the conference, however, to answer any questions you may have to ask, and perhaps to ask a few of our own. Like you, we will be praying that God will help us all and somehow bring glory to Himself out of this difficult problem. The letter contains a postscript stating that when Sam had finished writing the letter, he received a copy of the agenda for the scheduled meeting. And this is the next statement of the contents of that postscript. Quote, please note Jack Dean, Ed Erickson, Dave Weddle, Charles F. Baker, 1 hour and 20 minutes together, Sam 20 minutes, Wynn Johnson and Jeff Farrell, none. Ask yourself whether this does not fully justify our action above and our conclusion that the defenders of the college want to overwhelm and silence us rather than engage in a confrontation on equal terms over open Bibles. Okay, so now you're getting Sam and what he's saying about them and how they're choosing to conduct themselves. Now, I had a copy of this, and I forgot to bring it in the commotion before we left. I have a copy of the actual agenda from this meeting. It's portions of it I've reproduced for you here. Because Sam makes accusations in this postscript. They are accurate based upon as they appeared on the agenda. So let's look at this. September 26th to 28th, GGF Pastors Conference at the Ascott Hotel in Chicago, Illinois. This is the meeting to which Sam referred to above in his letter to an unnamed pastor. We have in our possession a copy of this agenda from this meeting. According to the agenda, the controversial parts of the meeting were to be handled as follows. So Tuesday, the 26th, there's supposed to be a consideration of the Journal of Grace Theology, which you could argue was largely responsible for creating the issue. That would include an editorial policy, a 20-minute statement. And the next topic, anti-intellectualism and the grace movement, Ed Erickson. Ed Erickson was the author of this journal article advocating for the reading of D.H. Warren's material. 20-minute statement. Spirit of Bereanism, David Weddle, 20-minute statement. Discussion will follow each 20-minute statement. Wednesday, charges and criticisms in respect to Grace Bible College. Since the pastors have received both points of view through the mail package pertaining to this subject, there will be only 20 minutes of introductory remarks from Cornelius R. Stam, 20 minutes, Charles Baker, 20 minutes. Discussion will follow each 20-minute statement. Ethical methods in respect to charges and criticisms and continuation of discussion on ethical methods. Thursday, our attitude toward growth in the grace movement. So, understand the postscript statement from the previous point where Stan is complaining about the deck being stacked against him. He's getting that from this agenda. Where what he perceives to be the opponent, he perceives to be outnumbered 3-1 in this discussion by three of his, who he perceives to be his opponents, each being afforded the opportunity to make 20-minute statements, and himself only a 20-minute statement, and nobody else on his side being allowed to make any such statements. Okay? Any questions about this? No? Got nothing really to sort of what it is, where it is, right? Top of page 5. I spoke to DeWitt about this, should say capital F, fall 1967 meeting at the Ascot Hotel in Chicago during a dinner meeting in July of this year. Going purely from memory, 46 years after the fact, DeWitt reported the following outcomes regarding this meeting. Okay? In that meeting, he said that in from his memory, somewhere between 80 and 90% of the pastors voted to support Dean Baker and Grace Bible College. Okay? And he said at the time that there was only minority support for Stam, which precluded his withdrawal from the GGF. Okay? So that's what he remembered in a dinner meeting in July of this year, reflecting back on what happened 46 years ago. Okay? Now, in this research, there's another pamphlet. Look at the next point. Stam paints a somewhat different picture in his March 31st, 1970 publication, Why Berean Bible Fellowship. Written in 1970, only about 3 years after the, should say, events at the Ascot Hotel in the fall of 1967, Stam writes the following. Quote, "Finally, a special GGF pastors conference was held in October." That is a misprint. It was, but I included it as it was in Stam's booklet. It was not held in October. It was held in September. "Finally, after a special GGF pastors conference was held in October, should be September, 1967, a deal with the problem at Grace Bible College. The results of this conference have been widely misrepresented. It has been reported that at this conference a resolution was passed clearing the school of all charges, and only three out of the 70 opposing this resolution. Actually, such a resolution was proposed by those supporting the college, but this resolution did not even get a second. Then, as the GGF's own published minutes show, another resolution was passed, not clearing the school of the charges, but dropping all present allegations. Further, the GGF records show that there were 9 out of 60, not 3 out of 70, who declined to support even this resolution. And it is well known that some of the 51 remaining voted for the resolution only to give the leaders of Grace Bible College another opportunity to reconsider and to return the college to the purpose for which it was founded." Now, a couple statements here. First of all, DeWitt in the dinner meeting is working from a 46-year-old memory of what happened 46 years ago. Stam, writing only 3 years after the fact, roughly, makes some statements or offers a different perception than what DeWitt offered in the dinner meeting. Okay? So it's important that you look at the next point. "After encountering these discrepancies in my research, I emailed Dr. DeWitt in early August 2013 a message containing the paragraphs quoted above. I asked him to compare Stam's comments with his recollection of the events. While I cannot share his entire answer because it contained many personal points that he asked me not to share in this setting, I can give you the gist of his response. According to DeWitt, the goal of the meeting was to gauge," that's spelled wrong, "the GGF support of Dean and Baker, or GBC, and gain an understanding of how the greater GGF saw the controversy. DeWitt did not dispute Stam's numbers in terms of the percentages involved in the voting, but stated that he had used 80 to 90% as a cautious number at our dinner meeting, not wanting to overstate things. Furthermore, DeWitt stated that it was probably true that the first resolution was made by the supporters of the college, but he had no recollection of whether or not that motion was ever seconded. However, he also indicates that Stam's statement regarding a second motion to, quote, drop all present allegations were probably correct. In terms of the meaning of the 51 votes in support of the college, DeWitt stated the following, quote, What they were voting on was whether to continue to support GBC, Dean, and Baker or not. There may have been some, possibly several, or even quite a few, who expressed privately to Stam that the meaning he describes in his article was the meaning of their vote. Formally, the vote was yes or no. So that, in the formalness of the vote was yay or nay. It was, in other words, he's saying it was a simple vote. But everything here was not all black and white among the two groups, the yays and the nays. I think there were many shades of opinion, and many probably had some reservation on both sides about their vote. That the whole of the 51 gave Baker and Dean their unqualified support would probably be an overstatement. But formally, the support for Baker and Dean and GBC was strong on the yes or no. Okay? So ultimately, DeWitt is not really disputing much about what Stam says in Wyvern Bible Fellowship from March 1970. Okay? All right. There's a lot of technicality stuff there. Any questions about any of that?
Should that read or should that be there on that? The last point, but formally the support for Dean and Baker and the GBC was very strong on the, should it say just the yes?
That's the way he wrote it.
Or no, that means, yeah, it's very...
What he means is, the people that voted in favor of the college, they may have had nuanced thinking, but they were generally voting to support the college. People that voted not to support the college probably had nuanced thinking also, and that they were voting generally to say they were not in support of the college, I think is generally what he's saying. Any other comments about that? Yeah.
Stam says 9 out of 60, which is 85%, and DeWitt says 80 to 90, so they're in a complete agreement on that.
Yeah, the percentages are not that off. And DeWitt is basically... The way I understood what he's saying is, Sam's basically telling it right of what happened. So, regardless of how one understands the events that transpired in Chicago during the fall of 1967, this is important. Sam did not immediately part company with the GGF. It was almost a year before Sam formally left in August of 1968. Therefore, it seems reasonable to assume that the outcome of the meeting at the Ascott Hotel did not immediately indicate to Stam that his controversy with GBC had come to an end or was hopeless. Or we theorize he would have parted company with the GGF and GBC much sooner. So whatever the outcome was, it seems reasonable to me, just knowing what I seem to feel I understand about Stam, if Stam felt at the end of this meeting that it was a complete lost cause, I think he would have just probably left shortly after the meeting was over, and wouldn't have waited almost an entire year to leave in August of 1968. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that seems reasonable to me to sort of understand it that way, given what we've observed about how Stam operated. Any comments about that? Okay. It's important to note that in DeWitt's email of August 2013, he was very clear that there was, quote, a range of values within the college faculty with respect to the neo-evangelical platform during the 1960s. Without quoting directly, DeWitt depicted the following continuum, okay? So it is, what he calls this range of values, he's basically ranking prominent members of the faculty in where they were at with respect to their agreement with the neo-evangelical agenda. And he puts himself at the top of the list. Okay? DeWitt was the most committed to the new evangelical platform, except in its renunciation of dispensationalism. Okay? This too needed to be reworked, as DeWitt did in his dispensational theology in America during the 20th century. Mm-hmm. He's still a dispensationalist. But what he's trying to do is he's trying to merge mid-acts dispensationalism with George Eldon Ladd's teaching on the kingdom. Okay? And the result of that is going to equal progressive dispensationalism. We'll talk more about that meeting later on. Okay? So understand what DeWitt's saying. What he's saying here is, look, I have the most in common with the neo-evangelicals, except what point? Anti-dispensationalism. But even in my dispensationalism, I felt that the traditional dispensationalism of the mid-Acts movement needed to be what? Revised and modified. Which is what he does if you read his book. But again, if you don't know the history here, you're going to read the book and be like, huh? I don't get it. Okay? The next individual was Dean. More conservative than DeWitt, Dean entertained aspects of the neo-evangelical agenda, especially in the realm of evangelism. Dean favored liberal arts education and was committed to counseling and pastoral ministry along with its psychological underpinning. He did not want to be called a fundamentalist if it meant being compared with an Appalachian snake handler. So, according to DeWitt, Dean's statement, I'm not a fundamentalist, meant, if you're calling me a fundamentalist, you mean I'm one of these crazy nuts in West Virginia handling snakes and doing all this hocus pocus stuff, then I'm not a fundamentalist. But he says, so Dean's issues are liberal arts, what he stood for primarily, and psychology. I told you my experience at the college a while back, that I was told by one of the pastoral students there that if I did not have training in psychology, that you could not be an effective pastor. Okay? And the psychology professor and the person he was working under was Dean. Okay? So then third on this range of values of this continuism was Baker. What DeWitt said about Baker is interesting. He says that Baker was the most conservative and cautious, and DeWitt suspects that Baker never quite fully understood the neo-evangelical movement. That's his estimation of Baker. His estimation of Baker is Baker didn't really ever grasp what was going on with the neo-evangelicals.
His answer to all of that was total silence.
And you pointed that out a couple times already. Baker was committed to the study of science, and it's been a part of the college's curriculum. DeWitt described all three men as having doubts about the creation research movement that started in the 60s. Mike mentioned that a few weeks back. Okay? So there you go. Again, the official position is we're not neo-evangelical in the sense that we're anti-dispensational. And we should have academic freedom to teach anything that is not in violation of what? The doctrinal statement of GBC and the GGF. Okay? Stam's key thing in identifying evangelicalism, neo-evangelicalism, was the anti-dispensationalism. So Mike, in his comment here, is also correct. These two, to some degree, are talking past each other. Because when Stan's saying neo-evangelicalism has made an incursion into the school, he's referring to the intellectualism, and he's also thinking about their dispensationalism. From this side of the coin, they're saying, hey, we have never not been dispensationalists. We've never not been dispensationalists. We may have entertained other things that weren't specifically prohibited in our doctrinal statement, but we've never been neo-evangelical in the sense that we've never been anti-dispensational. Does everybody understand that? I know it's a sort of a tangled web, I suppose, at this point, but I'm trying to do my best to get you to kind of grasp the totality of what's going on here. October 26, 1967. Dr. John P. Dean, that's the same as Jack Dean again, is officially inaugurated as the official second president of Grace Bible College. Given the facts above, this was probably not taken well by Stan. Yet he does not appear again to have immediately withdrawn from the GGF over it. At some point within the next 10 months, during the summer of 1968, Stan made the decision to withdraw from the GGF and form a new fellowship organization, the Berean Bible Fellowship, or BBF. We have much more to say about the events of 1968 in our next lesson. So any questions or comments on any of this, Norm?
Couldn't you take Dan's point about the school and maybe their position was lost in this whole thing?
Oh, I see his point. I do see his point. I think what I'm hoping we'll be able to do is to sort of step back from this board, as it were, and look at what's their side and what's their side, and at least try to understand the sides for what they are. Now, the way I think you should judge this is by the fruit of the ministries. Okay? Whoever is writing the controversy, I think, should not be judged based on what their arguments were or not, or how they were conducting themselves back here. I think this should all be judged based on the fruit of what came out of this. Okay? And again, this is in no way intended to be, you know, specifically offensive, but I think if you judge based on the fruit, and a production of men that are preaching mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalism, it seems to me that Sam's side was the correct one. Despite whatever ugliness or unfortunate manners in which he conducted himself in the middle of it. Okay? But I think if you judge it based on the fruit that it produced, which is the way I think you should judge it, I think that in the end, you're going to have to say, at least I would say, that the correct side I would go with, as far as who was sort of right in the end, I guess we have to do that at some point in this, is I would say that if you're judging this by the fruit of the ministries, that Sam is the one that held firm the mantle of a stance for clear Pauline truth. Okay? And that the college, starting in the 60s, possibly sooner, began to hedge on some of this stuff, and they largely still are. So, we've got a few minutes for any questions or comments, Lee.
I'd like to make a comment, whether it is meaningful to this discussion. Dr. Dean, I was always a good friend of Dr. Dean. I did always agree with him. But I always thought he was a very fair, kind, and he had a gentle disposition about it. I do know that Dr. Dean started out after college, after he graduated. He was a pastor of a church over in Wisconsin there, and then he got to the school and eventually became the president. He got embroiled into the, and this was where I had the tensions personally, and a lot of others did, was over the psychology and the counseling ministry. I will say this, as a matter of fact, that because I've been close to him, just before he died, I went to visit him. He's actually dying at the time. And before he died, he was pastor of the church out here at Belmar. Back in the past.
I thought he was in Byron Center.
Where was it?
Byron Center. Okay.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he was out there. Yeah, I didn't want that. So that would have put him back into the context of being a pastor, rather than a college president and embroiled in this. I don't know whether that tainted what he said to media as he was dying. I don't want to imply that he's actually dying on the deathbed, but he's dying of cancer. He told me that his greatest regret was that knowing what he knew now, he would have never, ever pursued the psychology and his education in the area of psychology and counseling. His greatest regret that he ever left or backed away from the pastoral ministry. And I always appreciated that he was, at least to me, whether he told it to others or not, I think it showed his heart was for the pastor and for that focus of ministry rather than, I took it to mean that the rest was a waste of time. He would have rather have stayed pastor.
Being a pastor of a church is definitely a different mindset than being a college professor.
Yes, and I've always known that. Thank you for the words.
Mike?
Well, at the time, there had been a lot of pressure on Grace Bible College because the Baptist college at the other end of town, now called Cornerstone, was doing the same thing regarding psychology, and it was all a Freudian approach to psychology, trying to synthesize Christianity with Freudian psychology. Grace College in Winona Lake, all the formerly fundamentalist schools were all going in that whole direction. So they were all trying. Only a few people like Jay Adams at the time was speaking out against Freudian psychology, and he's coming up with his own version of Mosaic counseling. And so he's a reformed theologian, so people were reluctant to accept some of the things he was saying. So there was a lot of pressure, though, on Grace Bible College, even to, knowing that to exist, they had to...
Well, there you go. Again, you just brought up a key point again. Okay, when the college moves from Wisconsin to Michigan, Michigan law, again, I need to remind you, this mandates that if you're going to be a professor, you have to have a degree higher than the level of student that you're teaching. So that meant all of the people that came and moved with the school in Michigan, they all had to go to graduate school. So when they went into graduate school in psychology and, you know, whatever it is, their subject matter, they're being exposed to that exact stuff that you were just discussing. And so what they're trying to do is, they are trying to do that, they're trying to synthesize what they're learning with what they, you know, with what their beliefs are over here. And it wasn't just a phenomenon that was occurring at Grace Bible College, it was happening all throughout, Christian... you know, institutions of higher learning, whether they, especially if they were trying to be a college. If they were going to remain a Bible institute, they didn't have to worry about any of this stuff. Because all they had to do was train the Bible and teach guys to preach, and, you know, if they saw fit, maybe teach them some Greek and some apologetics and, you know, stuff like that, but they didn't have to get into, you know, all this kind of stuff with them, and they didn't. And nor did this school when it was first founded. It was a Bible institute. They taught Bible. They taught theology. They had preaching classes. They taught guys to preach, and that was what it was for. But then, as time went on, they changed what they were doing, and those changes had some intended and many unintended consequences that affected them later on down the line. So, yeah, I think that's true. Anything else here? Yes.
The pocketbook of the parents at the time. If you had a bright kid who wanted to go into the ministry and you had the money to pay to send them somewhere, the attitude was more likely to send them to a college than a Bible institute.
And that's where I think this gets sort of dangerous, because you can put whatever you want on your college literature. You publish your doctrinal statement, this is what we're about, this is what we stand for, this is what we teach. Just because you have that written on that statement, it doesn't mean and or guarantee that that's what's being taught to that student in those classes. And I think that, and I think Sam viewed that as part of the worst part of this whole thing, is that parents were sending their young people to the school thinking they were getting one thing when they weren't.
And that's why he's going over their heads. Murders to the general public.
That's partly why.
That seems wrong. Is there a moral responsibility
of
somebody to let
their
parents know what's really going on?
Not an easy situation, that's for sure. But I'll go back. Let's go back. I go all the way back to the decision that they made in 44, 45 to even start the GGF. If they would have remained a group of loosely cooperative, independent Bible churches without this national council and without all this structure and hierarchy and all this stuff that they established, I'm not saying there wouldn't have been controversy, but there's nothing to put anybody out of. If a local assembly became dissatisfied with their pastor, the pastor was asked to leave, the church moved on. There wasn't anything overriding or above that entire churches and bodies of people are drug into
like they were back here, and to some degree still are, by the overarching politics of all this. So I think that the fundamental decision, the poor decision, was possibly made more than 20 years before when they decided to do this to begin with. I understand why they did it. Everybody was doing it. The IFCA, everybody was doing what they did. And they thought, this is what you're supposed to do. But I think that the wheels began to fall off of it when they began to organize at a level beyond the local church. Because when the Grace Movement had its power, it's when you had influential, regional, local churches, like O'Hare in Chicago and Colpin, Pennsylvania, and guys spread around the country that were just doing the ministry the way they thought they should do it and the way their people wanted it done, that you had a major groundswell of people that were hearing what they had to say and accepting it and believing it. As soon as you start to organize beyond that level, I think you start. That's where the real issues came into. That's the seedbed of all this trouble. So, anyway, we are actually done a few minutes early, if you can believe that.
Today, in that same context, at the GGF level, I don't think, at least they were requiring at one time, probably 10 years ago, that if you were already ordained, as I was and others, and had a legitimate ordination, they were requiring or wanted to require us to be reordained, which is... And now, when that happens, now you have the legitimate, you have the power of hierarchy on you. I won, I refused, I went through that mess once. I had my baptism of fire when I was ordained. I never thought I would do it again. But that's what they wanted, and they may be requiring that right now, that, and they want to have us reordained.
And again,
that happens in a lot of organizations. I'm familiar with some of the other the policies of some other denominations. That, for example, I preached quite often in some Pentecostal churches as I get there. Well, most of the preachers can care less, but now the Assemblies of God have really gotten tight on their. I'm not allowed. They will not authorize somebody who's not got the imprimatur or the stamp of approval to come and preach even an evangelistic meeting in their church.
Just think about what's going on here at this pastor's conference at the Ascott Hotel. The whole reason we're having a pastor's conference is because the GGF National Council said we're going to have a conference to settle this issue. So everyone sends their pastors to the National Conference. Where's that in the Bible? Where's that? Where is the following pattern for that type of? And look, I understand Jerusalem Council Acts 15. All right, well there you go. Well, as Paul goes out and establishes these churches, he establishes them as independent, fully functioning Bible churches with their own ordained elders that are responsible for the work of the ministry, and he never tells them to join any other sort of organization. So there's a lot of things going on here, okay? One of them I still maintain, and probably always will, goes back to the decision to establish the organization to begin with. And when Sam leaves, what does Sam do? He goes out and starts another what? Another organization. Because there's an organizational mentality that the only thing legitimate that's done for the ministry has to come from an organization. Okay, but more about that later. Thanks for your attention. We are now done on time.